Our first presentation today will be from Dr. Steven Kleeberger. Dr. Kleeberger is head of the Environmental Genetics Group and the Oxidative Stress Mechanism and Clinical Effects Group here at NIEHS. He earned an AB at Miami University in Ohio and a PhD at Kent State University. He is adjunct professor at Duke University and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He has published over 160 peer-reviewed articles and 24 book chapters and invited reviews. Dr. Kleeberger was professor of environmental health sciences at Johns Hopkins University before joining NIEHS in 2002. At NIEHS, he was the chief of the laboratory of respiratory biology from 2002 to 2010 and acting deputy director of NIEHS from 2009 to 2011. Dr. Kleeberger has given over 100 invited lectures worldwide. He served on multiple study sections at the NIH, advisory committees on genetic susceptibility, and EPA Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee review panels. His research utilizes genetic and genomic approaches to identify susceptibility genes for environmental lung disease. Dr. Kleeberger, I will turn this over to you.
Thanks, Mike, and welcome everyone. The title of my talk, as Mike had mentioned, is Genetic Mechanisms of Susceptibility to RSV Disease. And RSV is Respiratory Syncytial Virus. I realized after I made the slide that I forgot to put that on. So we're going to start by covering what RSV disease actually is. So this is a picture of a schematic drawing of Respiratory Syncytial Virus, or RSV. RSV is a ubiquitous enveloped RNA virus. Disease caused by RSV occurs as a well-defined seasonal outbreak during the winter and spring months. Here in the U.S., we are now entering RSV season. It's been pretty well documented that 70% of infants are infected within the first year of life, and by the age of 3 to 4 years old, more than 90% are infected. The primary cause of lower respiratory tract infection is RSV disease or RSV infection. 85 to 144,000 infants with RSV are hospitalized annually in the United States, resulting in approximately 20 to 25% with pneumonia and 70% with bronchiolitis. Annually, the global disease burden caused by RSV is approximately 64 million cases and causes 160,000 deaths per year. Unfortunately, there is no approved clinical vaccine for RSV, although many are in product development at this point. In the United States, the annual RSV case estimates are shown here. So on the left, are healthy children less than 5 years of age. There are approximately 140 to 500 deaths caused by RSV every year, 90 to 135,000 hospitalizations, and millions of medically attended events. And this is in a population of 20.2 million. So RSV does not limit itself to the very young. In fact, the elderly are also very much at risk in terms of disease caused by RSV, and in fact, there are more deaths in adults greater than 65 than in children less than 5. As you can see, between 3,000 and 12,000 deaths, tens of thousands of hospitalizations, hundreds of thousands of medically attended events in a cohort of about 40 million. So it affects a large portion of our population in the United States. Globally, on this slide, this is a paper published in Lancet in 2012. On the left shows the causes of morbidity and mortality in children up to 27 days of age. If you look in the lower left-hand quadrant of that pie in the green, these are respiratory ailments. And you can see, if you look real carefully, that RSV represents the highest percentage of morbidity and mortality worldwide in children less than 27 years of age, or days of age. And in children from 28 to 364 days, that is up to 1 year, on the right, that incidence actually grows. so that 6.7% of all morbidity and mortality in this age group is caused by RSV infection. So RSV is a very serious public health concern, and as I mentioned earlier, there is no approved vaccine. And understanding those factors that contribute to differential susceptibility to RSV are extremely important to understand. So a number of studies have been done over the years looking at the mechanisms of susceptibility and response to RSV infection. And multiple mediators, chemokines, cytokines, MHC molecules, growth factors, pattern recognition receptors, like toll receptors 1 through 10, have all been associated at some point with RSV infection. A lot of attention has also focused on the innate immune response, shown on the left, as well as the adaptive immune response, shown on the right. The innate immune response, shown here, involves interferons, interleukins 12 and 18, as well as TNF, and represents the innate, that is, the early response to RSV infection, whereas the adaptive response on the right is the secondary response that's initiated by the innate immune. And you can, if you look closely on the right-hand side of the slide, the skewing from the TH0 to TH2 is often associated with immunopathology, that is severe disease, whereas if the host is skewed to the TH1-like response, there is conferred immunoprotection. And I'm going to be coming back to this later on during this presentation. So how do we understand the genetic basis of susceptibility to RSV disease, as well as any other disease of the lung? So traditionally, family-based studies in humans, as well as twin studies, and more recently, genome-wide association studies, or GWAS, have been used. There are also association studies, and these are very useful, but the candidate genes that they use for association studies must be very carefully selected. In other words, the genes must have a known biologic plausibility. Animal models have also been proven to be very useful to identify genes that contribute to RSV disease subphenotypes. Gene expression arrays have been used, and I'm going to tell you about some genome scan studies that we have performed to identify gene candidates. So this is a schematic representation of the strategy to identify environmental lung disease susceptibility genes that we have adopted in my laboratory. So we take advantage of a number of inbred strains of mice that are available from Jackson Laboratories as well as other commercial suppliers. We also use human cell lines, and these combined methods we use to incorporate tools for global gene expression analysis, expression quantitative trait or EQTL analysis, as well as haplotype association mapping, which is what I'm going to show you today. We combine these approaches to identify candidate genes and candidate gene networks, and we also consider biologically plausible gene candidates that may not come up in our own studies. We then, after identifying these gene networks and candidate genes, we test them in human populations after mechanistically identifying functionality of the genes and gene networks. And you can see that there is an arrow going from mechanistic in mouse and cell lines to human populations because both can inform the other. So today, I'm going to talk about two studies that we have done. One is murine, that is mouse RSV disease susceptibility. And then in the second project, I'm going to talk about RSV disease, toll-like receptor 4, which is one of those innate immunity genes that I pointed out earlier, and their interaction with the environment to contribute to disease severity after RSV infection. So the first study, we asked what are the genetic determinants of susceptibility in a mouse model of severe RSV-induced disease. And to do this, we infected 30-some strains of mice with RSV, and then evaluated the time course of the response to RSV in the lung. And we did this by using bronchoalveolar lavage, which is simply washing out the lung, at two different time points after infection, 1 day and 5 days post-infection. And there are multiple phenotypes that we obtain using bronchoalveolar lavage. One of those phenotypes is the influx of polymorphic nuclear leukocytes, or PMNs, that's shown in the left panel. And what you can see is on the y-axis is the number of PMNs that we get in the lavage. On the x-axis is the response to vehicle. And then 1 day and 5 days post-infection with RSV. And I'm showing you two different strains of mice and their response to RSV. One is called BALB-C, and the other is called C3HHEJ, or C3H. And what you will see is that there is a significant increase in PMNs compared to vehicles 1 day after infection, which largely attenuates after 5 days of infection. On the right are the number of PMNs that we found in the BAL. And again, vehicle, 1 and 5 days post-RSV infection. And unlike the PMNs, the number of monocytes, which are markers of the acquired immune response, they peak at 5 days after infection. And I'm not showing you here, but this largely dissipates by about 2 weeks after infection. So there are two very important take-home points from this slide. One is that the kinetics of response depends upon which response you're looking at. And secondly, that there is a significant difference in the response depending upon the strain of mouse that you look at. So in this case, the BALB-C mouse was very susceptible to RSV infection and response, whereas the C3HHEJ mouse mounted a very minimal response to RSV. The next slide shows four different phenotypes across all the different strains of mice that we phenotyped for the response to RSV. On the top panel are the monocytes that we counted. The second panel is lymphocytes, which is again an acquired immune response. The PMNs, which I mentioned before. And then on the bottom panel is the actual amount of RSV in the lung at 1 and 5 days after infection with RSV. And there are a number of take-home points from these panels. One, as I showed you in the previous slide, there is significant interstrain variation in these responses, whether it's monocytes, lymphocytes, PMNs, or the amount of RSV in the lung. The second point is that there's a continuous distribution of these phenotypes across the strains. So if you look at the monocytes, you can see that there is a gradual increase across all the different strains. Sorry, I didn't mention this, but all the strains are on the bottom, the x-axis. So this continuous distribution suggests that this is a multigenic trait. The third point is that there is a lack of correlation between the phenotypes. In other words, likely there are different genes that control these different responses to RSV. So we took each of these responses and we did a genome-wide association study for each of those responses. And what I'm showing you on this slide is a Manhattan plot for RSV-induced monocytes in those different strains of mice using an algorithm called SNPster. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Manhattan plot, on the x-axis are all of the chromosomes in the mouse, so 19 autosomes, as well as the X chromosome. On the y-axis is the log p value of the association between the phenotypes of all the different strains of mice and markers along these chromosomes. So each point that you see on each of the chromosomes is a single marker. And what these algorithms do is ask whether the phenotypes associate with this differentially expressed marker. And what we found for this particular phenotype was a very strong association on chromosome 1 in the mouse. Now, we can look more closely at this particular point on chromosome 1, which is what this enlargement is showing. And again, this is the length of this portion of chromosome 1 on the x-axis, the association on the y-axis, and these lines here in this region indicate the genes that are found in this particular part of chromosome 1. One of the gene candidates that we found is under this peak on chromosome 1, and the gene that we identified as potentially an important modifier of susceptibility is called MARCO. Now I'm going to explain a little bit about what MARCO is. So MARCO is an innate immune gene, and its real name is macrophage receptor with collagen structure. It's a member of a very primitive scavenger receptor family, and what I mean by primitive, it's found across vertebrates as well as invertebrates. And this particular gene, MARCO, fits in this subcategory or subfamily A, and is similar to SRCL and SRA1. To test whether this particular gene is important in the response to RSV infection, we took advantage of mice that have targeted deletion of MARCO, that is, they have a non-functional MARCO in their genome, and we infected them with RSV and compared them with a wild-type mouse. And what you can see on the left are the monocytes that we found in the MARCO knockout versus the MARCO wild-type. And you can see there are significant, at 5 days, a significantly greater number of monocytes in the knockout compared to the wild-type. On the right panel, you can see that the number of PMNs is markedly increased in the knockout mice compared to the wild type, which is supportive of the hypothesis that MARCO is, in fact, important in the mouse response to RSV infection. And so this information was encouraging, and we next asked, what is the role of this particular gene in human RSV disease severity? And to do that, we have, over the years, been collaborating with an investigator at the Infant Foundation in Buenos Aires. In fact, he founded this foundation. His name is Dr. Fernando Pollack. He also has an appointment at Vanderbilt. And the Infant Foundation is focused on basic and clinical research around children's respiratory diseases with the goal to find mechanisms and ultimately treatments for infectious diseases in neonates and in infants. So this is a schematic in the upper left of this slide showing a map of Buenos Aires and its suburbs. We recruit in all four of these areas. For the purposes of this talk, I'm going to focus on these three, that is west, south, and center. You'll see that west and south are low-income regions of Buenos Aires, and center is an area of some influence, that is middle to upper middle class in Buenos Aires, and I'll come back to that point later in my talk. So we've recruited over the years a number of children from these hospitals, and with the goal of asking or identifying gene candidates that might be important in disease severity. The clinical outcomes that we have in these kids that are exposed and infected to RSV, so the primary outcome is the severity of the disease, that is an oxygen saturation of less than 93%. And the secondary outcome is RSV titer and Th2 cell polarization, and I'll come to that later on. So this slide is showing you the homology, that is the relative similarity between the mouse MARCO gene and the human MARCO gene. So on the left is the relative location of MARCO. In the mouse, it's on chromosome 1, as I showed you before. In a human, it's on chromosome 2, but you'll note if you look carefully that the order and structure of the genes are very similar in these two regions of mouse and human. And if you go to the right of the slide, you will see that there are informative polymorphisms in this particular region of the human Marco, and in particular right here with that green triangle, is a polymorphism in the promoter region of human Marco. So we, because it was predicted to have a adverse outcome in the expression of the gene, we tested that in vitro using cell culture models, and we found that if you mutate the RSV gene at that particular position in the promoter, the activity of the gene is severely compromised or reduced. We also found that if you have this particular polymorphism in vitro, that the infection of the cell lines is significantly enhanced. So these data suggested to us that this may be a viable, not only gene candidate, but a polymorphism in the gene that we could ask whether it is important in human populations. So in our populations in Buenos Aires, we genotype them for that particular SNP. And what you see in this rather complex figure is in one population shown here, we found that the proportion of individuals with severe disease was greater than with the mutated allele in Marco than in individuals that had the normal allele. This was repeated in a second population, and when you combine the populations, you again see that the severity of disease is associating with this polymorphism in Marco to the point where approximately 1.6-fold increased risk of disease if you have this particular polymorphism. So we have gone from mouse to humans using our inbred strains of mouse approach and identified a gene candidate that we believe to be important in RSV disease, and we are currently looking at other genes as well based on our modeling. So the second study I'm going to cover fairly quickly. This is a candidate gene approach study where we asked what is the role of the interaction between toll-like receptor 4, which I mentioned previously, TOL4, and environmental exposure to endotoxin, or LPS, in human disease severity.
Steve, this is Mike. You have about 5 minutes left.
Perfect. Thanks, Mike. So this is the map of Buenos Aires that I showed you previously. We've got an area of relative influence, and then two areas of low socioeconomic status or low income regions. And we took advantage of this particular demographic. These are some of the characteristics of homes in the west and the south of the low socioeconomic status. Poverty line 22%, illiteracy, no private insurance, well water, no sewer, you can see are all greater in the west and south than the center. So this is evidence, or further evidence, that in fact the high socioeconomic status is very different from the low socioeconomic status. So this is on the A panel on the y-axis, a percentage of households with endotoxin levels, and what you see is, so on the first grouping, this is low endotoxin levels, and you can see that there are many more homes with high socioeconomic status that have low endotoxin, and with higher endotoxin levels, more with high socioeconomic with low socioeconomic status have high endotoxin. And in these same groups, the low socioeconomic status and high socioeconomic status, infants have colonization of bacteria in their nasopharyngeal washes, which indicates, again, secondary infections with the RSV infection. What we found is after we genotyped these individuals, those individuals with low LPS, that is high socioeconomic status, if they had a mutation in this toll-like receptor gene, they were much more at risk for developing severe disease than mild disease. whereas those individuals in the high LPS, that is the low socioeconomic status region, and you had the mutation, you had a much greater chance of having mild disease than severe disease. This was repeated in another population. And when you combine the populations, you can see that the odds ratio for severity is between 8 and 10, which is quite high, for high socioeconomic status and the mutation. Whereas if you had low socioeconomic status and the mutation, you were protected. So this is a classic sort of gene by environment interaction for RSV and socioeconomic status. We began to explore mechanisms. This is a schematic showing transcription factors that are important for TH1 and TH2 skewing. So TBAT is a transcription factor for TH1 type cytokines, and if you remember, that's immunoprotective. GATA3 is a transcription factor that leads to TH2 type cytokines, which are can lead to pathology or pathogenesis. And what we find, I'll wrap this up real quickly, is that if you have a high ratio of the GATA3 to TBAT, you are likely to have severe disease compared to mild, and also have high risk for disease compared to low risk. And these are cytokines that associate with those particular transcription factors and are consistent with the hypothesis that there is TH2 bias and effect on RSV bronchiolitis. So what is the public public health relevance of these models? As I mentioned earlier, the annual global RSV disease burden is over 30 million. New lower respiratory tract infection episodes in children under 5, that's by the WHO, World Health Organization. Severe RSV disease in infancy has also been associated with diseases of childhood and adulthood, for example, asthma. And we suggest that if you have a way to identify individuals with genetic polymorphisms that contribute to susceptibility, then we might be able to intervene and perhaps reduce the risk of disease caused by RSV infection. I'd like to acknowledge all the people who contributed to this project. This is me on the left. These are folks in my lab who are working diligently on this project. And this is a picture of NIEHS down in North Carolina, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Kleeberger. If people have questions, again, please feel free to submit them to the question and answer pod that you see in the lower right-hand corner. I will resist the urge of saying polo every time I heard Marco. I just instinctively wanted legitimate question, though, that came in. This is asking for a little clarification. So with the Marco polymorphism, how are you defining mild versus severe disease?
So that's a great question. So all the kids that are admitted into the hospital have RSV infection, and they come in with at least some symptoms of bronchiolitis, and we define severe disease versus mild disease based on the oxygen saturation in these kids. So the O2 sats are monitored continuously, and if they fall below 93% saturation, then they are classified as severe disease. If they're above 93%, then they have mild disease. So all the kids that we're studying have RSV infection. It's just the severity of the disease that results from the infection differs markedly between the two groups. So I hope that clarifies.
A follow-up question, is there a difference with age?
So that's a great question, too. And we are, in these studies, looking at kids that are all less than 9 months of age. And so we haven't looked yet, at least genetically, at kids older than that. As I showed early in the presentation, the kids that are at greatest risk are up to 1 year of age. although children from 1 to 5 are also at risk. In fact, otherwise healthy kids could be at extreme risk if they have the appropriate sort of genetic predisposition. But that's sort of a long way of saying that, no, we haven't yet looked at older kids, mostly those less than 9 months of age.
Okay. Another question that came in. Aside from socioeconomic status, what are additional environmental determinants of RSV infection?
So we have extensive epidemiologic questionnaire sorts of data for these kids. We have found that, and we've published this a number of years ago, we found that breastfeeding is also an important risk factor, but it's gender specific. And so it helps infants that are male, but does not seem to help infants that are female. So breastfeeding is really important, but it's gender dependent. I mentioned socioeconomic status, so endotoxin and co-infections, as I mentioned previously, in the nasopharyngeal region are important. Smoking is important. Siblings, number of siblings, daycare, all of those things could be contributors. So again, the point I was trying to make is that, like what has been shown or hypothesized for asthma, is that the hygiene hypothesis is potentially very important in severity of disease. And so if your immune system is appropriately stimulated early in childhood, you may be protected, again, depending upon genetic background, but you may be protected against the severity of RSV disease. And so exposures to those agents that can stimulate the immune system early on could be very important in determining susceptibility.
I guess as a follow-up, a susceptibility question was submitted. Would mutated Markov gene necessarily lead to susceptibility to childhood asthma?
So that's also a great question. And there are a number of studies, and I think most people would agree that severe RSV disease is an important contributor to the incidence of asthma. And so our working hypothesis is that if we are able to understand those factors that contribute to susceptibility to RSV disease and are able to prevent disease based on administration of an antiviral like palivizumab, you may in fact be able to impact the incidence of asthma later in life. So the implications of understanding those factors that contribute to differential susceptibility could affect not only disease susceptibility, but also downstream or later on sequelae like asthma and reactive airways disease.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. Are there any other questions to be submitted through the Q&A pod? Okay. We have a few minutes. If anyone on the phone would like to submit a question, we can go to the phone lines for just a few minutes. Again, if you have a question on the phone, you need to take your phone off mute by hitting #6. We then ask that you state your name and organization and then ask your question, and then you can remute your phone by going *6. So are there any questions from the phone? Okay, well, hearing no further questions on the phone or seeing none, no more questions come up on the box. Oh, we just got a question. Okay. Another question, is it known what steers the immune system towards TH1 versus TH2 response?
I'm sorry, Mike, would you repeat that, please?
Sure. Is it known what steers the immune system towards the TH1 versus TH2 responses?
Well, so we understand some of the mechanisms through which that occurs. And so, as I mentioned in one of my slides, I had to gloss through that pretty quickly. So there are two transcription factors that have been found to be really important in this TH1, TH2 skewing. So GATA3 is one of those transcription factors, and TBET is another one. And it's been proposed that activation of these transcription factors results in the upregulation of certain genes that are involved in either the TH1 or TH2. So GATA3 induction by factors that are not clearly understood would lead to a skewing towards TH2 kinds of cytokines and result in immune profile. Activation of the TBET transcription factor, again by factors that are not completely understood, leads to the upregulation of genes that contribute to the TH1 profile. And understanding the mechanisms through which these transcription factors lead to this skewing is a very important and heavily studied area of investigation at this point. And what we found, again, I glossed over this pretty quickly, is that if you looked at the ratio of the expression between TBET and GATA3, if you had an increased expression of GATA3 relative to TBET, you were more likely to have severe disease, and TH2 skewing. Whereas if you had low GATA3 TBET ratios, you were more likely to have TH1 skewing and lower risk of severe disease. So that's pretty much what we understand at this point in RSV disease severity.
I realize you might not know the answer for this, but going back to the breastfeeding and how that seems to help males and not females, is there any kind of any known difference between like the GATA3 response or levels that you were just discussing?
So that's one of the things that we're investigating at this point. We don't completely understand the mechanism through which this breastfeeding affects differentially based on gender. We have some hypotheses that it has to do with estrogen receptors, but these are hypotheses that we're currently testing. So there is mother-to-child transmission of slight immunity to RSV, and this presumably occurs through breast milk, but it's not very long-lasting. And again, we don't know why this happens in one gender versus another.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Kleeberger.
Sure.
And thank you to all those who submitted questions. I think we will now move on to our next presentation. We will next hear from Dr. Fena Saleh. Dr. Saleh recently started as assistant professor in the Environmental Health and Sciences Department of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Her research goal is to understand the long-term effects of early life exposures on the immune system and subsequently chronic and infectious disease risks. For this research, she combines her expertise in immunotoxicology, microbiology, and functional genomics with metabolomics and exposure epidemiology. Dr. Saleh received an MS in immunology and molecular virology from the University of Groningen and received her PhD in immunology in 2010 from the Utrecht University for her work performed at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. She then completed two postdoctoral positions at UC Berkeley. Her immunotoxicology research has garnered her awards from the Society of Toxicology, as well as the NorCal Society of Toxicology. In 2015, she was awarded the NIH Pathway to Independence Award, the K99R00, for her ongoing work investigating the long-term effects of early life arsenic exposure on immunity in the context of chronic and infectious disease risks. So Dr. Soleil, I will now turn this over to you.
Thank you so much, Mike, and thank you all for allowing me to present my work today. First, I would like to start with a little introduction of the immune system, because as I am interested in the early life effects of arsenic exposure in this case on later life disease outcome and disease risk, from an immunologist perspective, I'm focusing on the immune system that is important in many of these chronic diseases and infectious diseases. So our immunity towards any kind of disease is basically dependent on a balance in the homeostasis of the immune system, and so that the net effect of the immune system is not putting you at a disease stage. However, this balance can be disrupted by environmental exposures such as pharmaceuticals, pollutants, toxic chemicals, but also dietary microbial metabolites. And if this, if these exposures, for example, shift the homeostatic immune balance towards immunosuppression, this may lead to enhanced susceptibility towards cancer or infectious diseases, because the immune system is not as responsive as it should be. On the other hand, the balance of this immune net effect could also lead to immunoenhancement, so an overreactive immune response, which then can lead to autoimmune diseases, hypersensitivity and allergy, inflammatory diseases, and tissue damage. And then it's not as black and white as this, because often environmental exposures can target different components of the immune system, which then also leads to multiple of these disorders. So for the purpose of this talk, I would like to focus on arsenic and how arsenic affects the immune system and subsequently changes or affects the infectious and chronic disease risk. So arsenic is a heavy, is a metalloid component which is abundant throughout the world in the soil and ends up in groundwater because it's water soluble. And as you can see on this map, there are many regions across the world that have high levels of arsenic. More than 10 micrograms per liter is what the US EPA considers the cutoff for safe drinking water. And these regions include the U.S. There are actually more than around estimated 30 million people that either rely on drinking water from a private well or very small municipalities that do not have the huge water treatment plants facilities to remove arsenic from drinking water. And then this is actually a map from 2008, but I've spoken to scientists who have been studying Southeast Asia, and they say that arsenic exposure or arsenic, the prevalence of arsenic in groundwater is much higher in Southeast Asia than is depicted on this map. So how does arsenic, how do we get exposed to arsenic? There are different ways that arsenic can be released from the ground into our drinking water sources or into our food chain. And this can be, or even in the air that we breathe. And this can be due to industrial or agricultural uses of arsenic. Mining releases a lot of arsenic, and then if it ends up in the water that is used in, or the aquifers that are close to these mines, arsenic can end up in groundwater, but also arsenic is heavily used as a pesticide or in agricultural purposes, so it's spread in manure all over agricultural land. It has been used as an antipyrocytic and antimicrobial agent in chicken feed and other livestock. and it has been used as a preservative in paints and as wood preservatives to treat wood. As I mentioned, we can also be exposed to arsenic through the air, and especially if coal-burning mines use coal that is high in arsenic levels. But despite this, the biggest way of contamination of arsenic exposure is through contaminated drinking water. As I mentioned already, throughout the world, there are many people that rely still on direct well water or small municipalities with drinking water that comes straight out of the ground and barely treated to remove arsenic and other metals or other chemicals. And then finally, because arsenic is water soluble and it can also end up in our food chain if crops such as rice are grown in arsenic contaminated water. So arsenic has many adverse health effects, and these range from skin lesions, cancers, multiple types of cancers such as skin, lung, bladder, and kidney cancer predominantly, but also cardiovascular diseases, reproductive effects, diabetes, respiratory diseases, and many more, and to such an extent that the World Health Organization has declared arsenic exposure a major public health concern. And because of this, many groups are studying the health effects of arsenic exposures. Through my collaborations with Professor Martin Smith, Professor Alan Smith, and Dr. Craig Steinmoss at UC Berkeley, as well as Dr. Caterina Ferreccio at the Pontificia Universidad Católica in Chile, I have access to a unique human population in Chile. In the northern part of Chile, here in the town of Antofagasta, it's a desert town, and it relies heavily on drinking water, or it used to rely heavily on drinking water from rivers that came from the Sierra. And in the 1950s, the town started to expand, and they added an extra river for their drinking water sources, but unfortunately without testing. So as you can see in this graph, the second river that they added to their water supply had enormous amounts of arsenic naturally occurring in their river water, and up to 800 micrograms per liter. And this is, as I mentioned before, the US EPA cutoff for safe drinking water is 10 micrograms per liter. So this is almost more than 80 times higher than safe. And it took them quite a few years, 12 years, to figure it out, because cardiovascular disease, for example, in young adults, was the mortality of cardiovascular disease was increased. So that triggered them to look for causes of this increased mortality. And then 12 years later, the arsenic removal plant was finally finished and installed, and the levels of arsenic exposure dropped to what they were before in 1971. So this provides a unique window of exposure that at the time, the adults that were exposed to arsenic displayed cardiovascular disease risk, but we could also follow the people that were born during this period and follow them now up to 40, 50 years later to see what the health effects of this exposure was. And indeed, as you can see in this graph, there were many adverse health effects related to this exposure window. In the light blue graph, you can see that people that were born right before the exposure, so from 1950 to 1957, so they were young kids, but they were already born. And then when they were exposed, when they were as young kids, their mortality rate of bronchiectasis is 40 years later. So mind you, these are now adults at this stage. The mortality risk from bronchiectasis, other COPDs, lung cancer, but also kidney and bladder cancer were much higher. Interestingly, the people that were born during this time, so they had in utero exposure or very early life exposure, that's the black graph in this piece of the graph, express even higher mortality rates than people that were already born before the exposure scenario. And that's all compared to the rhesus tumor, which is the white bar. So this provides us with a very unique exposure scenario where there's a specific defined window of exposure, and people that are either exposed only in utero or only in early life versus adult exposure and exposure later in childhood. And as you can see here, sorry, I flipped, that's it, a bit too far. It's the rare evidence supporting the developmental origins of health and disease hypothesis. And this hypothesis basically relies on the idea that maternal exposures that occur affect the fetus, the unborn fetus, and the developmental changes that it undergoes during gestation, but also exposures can occur through lactation afterwards, so it can still affect the children and their development of all kinds of crucial developmental processes that occur during birth and after birth. So what was very interesting that we found is that even this early life exposure was also associated with increased mortality rates from tuberculosis later in life. So the tuberculosis infection didn't co-occur with the arsenic exposure. So the arsenic exposure occurred early in life, and then TB later in life still had increased mortality risk in this population. And that was very interesting and has very triggered my interest as an immunologist, because what could technically be happening so early in life that triggers and sets you up for increased chronic and infectious disease risk later in life. And to come back to the TB, if you look at the arsenic prevalence map and that I mentioned that Southeast Asia, for example, also has increased much higher levels of arsenic in the groundwater. And you overlap this with the tuberculosis incidence map from the World Health Organization, you can see that there is, especially in Southeast Asia, but also in South America, there is a lot of overlap between arsenic exposure and TB incidence. And even countries such as the U.S. with low incidence of tuberculosis, but they have high levels of arsenic in certain regions, are still at risk for basically these two global health problems at the same time because of people traveling globally now and introducing TB cases in these low incidence regions. So there is definitely a co-risk for these two public health concerns. And the World Health Organization has stated that it's actually very surprising that although there is very much health and wealth improvement across the world, that infectious diseases such as tuberculosis are still resistant, that's still persistent and so widespread and cause still the majority of the mortality worldwide is still due to respiratory infections, for example, including TB. So it may be that environmental exposures are what affect this high mortality of infectious diseases. And this combination of arsenic and tuberculosis is a unique combination to study this interaction. So what can possibly occur so early in life that an early life exposure can affect and have health effects and increase mortality so much later, 40, 50 years later in life? And as I mentioned, from an immunology perspective, this points towards the immune system, because the immune system is being predominantly developed in the starting at the 7th week of gestation. T cells, B cells, macrophages, but also after birth, a lot of the immune system is still being developed. For example, the TH1 and TH2 skewing that was mentioned before in the previous talk, and also specialization of certain cells and memory is one of the ones that actually goes throughout life. But it takes many years and for the immune system to be complete, as a matter of fact, until 18 years when everything is in place. But the gestational period and the first 2-3 years of life are the most critical for immune development. So for this talk, we would also like to point out that we'll focus on macrophages, which also are initiated in the early weeks of gestation. And this is because we were interested in effects of lung cancer and tuberculosis, which are diseases of the lung, and macrophages are one of the key immune cells that are important in the lung. So the general hypothesis that we had is that exposure-induced immune developmental changes contributes to this persistent global burden of infectious and chronic diseases. And we use arsenic and TB as the models to study this. In specific, we focused on how early life exposure to arsenic, how that alters the macrophage development and function, and how that causes increased disease later in life. So macrophages are innate immune cells that are specialized to quickly recognize foreign particles or, for example, bacteria, and respond to that and activate then the rest of the immune system later, the adaptive immune system. So macrophages can scavenge, and then they can also secrete cytokines and chemokines to recruit and trigger the rest of the immune system. They can do this also by signaling lipids that they secrete. And they also make antimicrobial components such as nitric oxide to directly kill a pathogen on site, for example. Unfortunately, for making it harder for us to study macrophages, they have a bit of a two or maybe even a more fluid, but many faces that they portray, in the sense that they have different profiles that focus either on pro-inflammation, so they can be pro-inflammatory and they have bactericidal activity and they suppress tumors. But on the other hand, the field calls the M2 profile, they can be scavenging, they function in tissue repair and they promote angiogenesis, and tumors can basically hijack the properties of these macrophages and use it especially for angiogenesis and tissue repair for their own tumor promotion. So macrophages can contribute to a microenvironment that's either protective in an infectious disease model, or it can actually be tumor promoting. And that's how we think macrophages could also upon arsenic exposure contributes both to a tumor-promoting environment that leads to lung cancer or to a suppressive immune suppression that makes room for infectious diseases such as TB and increased mortality of TB. So how does arsenic alter macrophages? So to study this, we started out with a mouse model and basically an in vitro model where we culture mouse bone marrow into macrophages. We differentiate them into macrophages, and then we treated them with arsenic for several time points. And then we took the cell lysate or the supernatant, where we extracted the lipid metabolites out of this, and we analyzed these by LCM mass spec. And these signaling lipids are important for recruitment and for creating a microenvironment that is either protective or tumor promoting by these macrophages. And we looked at the lipids, and by untargeted lipid analysis, We found that 42 lipids were upregulated and 53 lipid metabolites were reduced. And we're still in the process of figuring out from this untargeted analysis what these lipids may be. Fortunately, we also did some targeted analysis, and this is in resting macrophages that have been differentiated and treated with arsenic. And we focused on several lipid groups that were important for signaling in the immune system. And we found that acyl carnitines, eicosanoids, sphingolipids, ether lipids, lysophospholipids, and phospholipids were affected by arsenic exposure. And particularly some that were pro-inflammatory and are known to be pro-tumorigenic signaling lipids. So we also looked at other factors that macrophages secrete, which are the signaling proteins called cytokines and chemokines. So they're actually very important also to recruit the rest of the adaptive immune system to the site of infection, for example. And similarly, we did that by studying mouse bone marrow that was differentiated into macrophages treated with arsenic. And then we extracted from the cell lysate or from the supernatant that was excreted. We did a multiplex analysis on this to look for cytokine and chemokine expression. And we found that indeed arsenic exposure, even a few hours already of arsenic exposure, these macrophages affected the cytokine levels. And you can see that in this slide a bit better, that arsenic affects several pro-inflammatory cytokines. And it was actually a reduction of cytokines and chemokines that we observed after arsenic exposure. And for example, MCP1, just to highlight one of them, is also called CCL2, is one of the chemokines that is important to recruit other immune cells to the site of infection, for example.
Fenna, so, you have 5 minutes left.
Okay, yeah. So that was during homeostasis, because homeostatic macrophages keep that immune balance in place, but they're best when they're activated. And activation can be mimicked in vitro by triggering the toll-like receptor pathway. And we did that by palmitoylcysteine activation of the toll-like receptor 2. So after arsenic exposure and activation of toll-like receptor 2, we found that in the similar as during homeostasis, we also found that MCP1, for example, was reduced if there was an arsenic exposure of these macrophages. Activated macrophages are also very good at secreting nitric oxide, which is antibacterial. And we found that if macrophages were pre-exposed to arsenic before they were activated, there was a reduction in the nitric oxide production. So this shows basically, if you conclude this, that on the one hand, where you have the M1 pro-inflammatory profile with bactericidal activity, we find suppression of cytokines and nitric oxide. But on the other hand, eicosanoids, for example, prostaglandin and other factors were increased, suggesting that the balance was skewed towards an M2, more M2 and less M1, so more tumor promoting and less pro-inflammatory and bactericidal. And if we did KEG pathway analysis of our findings, the tumor-promoting pathways came up. And this review shows very well how these components can influence tumor formation. For example, prostaglandin promotes tumor growth. But if you have a reduction of certain cytokines and chemokines, you basically block infiltration of the immune system to fight the tumor growth. Other factors, signaling lipids that we found, were promoting angiogenesis. So this is how arsenic could actually create a microenvironment in these macrophages that favor tumor progression. We were even more excited when the CHEG pathway analysis came up with the tuberculosis pathway, and then in particularly the NOD-like receptor, Toll-like receptor, and PPR signaling pathways. And these are all pathways that are important for pathogen pattern recognition and important for the immune response against tuberculosis and other infectious diseases. So to follow up on that, we wanted to know if indeed arsenic also alters tuberculosis outcomes. So after culturing macrophages with arsenic, subjected them to Mycobacterium tuberculosis infection and were curious about the titers of bacteria that would grow in these macrophages. And we found that if we pre-expose these macrophages to arsenic, we had an increased burden of Mycobacterium tuberculosis in these macrophages. So suggesting that arsenic during differentiation actually makes these macrophages more susceptible to TB infection. So in conclusion, we have found evidence from our in vitro assays that macrophages are affected by arsenic exposure, and that this arsenic exposure actually tilts the immune balance towards a suppression of the M1 phenotype of macrophages, so blocking pro-inflammatory and bactericidal activity and promoting a tumor environment, that tumor promotion. And this could explain why we find in the early life exposed people more higher mortality rates from lung cancer and higher mortality rates from tuberculosis because of this shift. And the next step is to complete our in vitro experiments with more time points, also during differentiation of the macrophages when they develop versus afterwards when they're already mature. And we have preliminary data from our in vivo models where we have both current as well as early life arsenic exposed mouse studies. And when we looked at tuberculosis co-exposure after arsenic exposure, and we found from plating lungs that the burden, likewise as in the macrophages, was much higher upon arsenic exposure than when the mice are not exposed to arsenic and then get TB. And eventually, we want to translate these findings to our human population study, and because we have blood samples from the Chilean early life arsenic exposed people, and we can study the monocytes and the macrophages that we can derive from those monocytes to see if we find similar susceptibility to tuberculosis and similar skewing of the immune balance in these macrophages. So we will similarly screen for signaling molecules and lipid metabolites, not just in macrophages, but also in other immune cells. We'll test immune function during disease, particularly during the tuberculosis diseases and infections. And we hope to understand how the long-term effects of early life exposure cause later life disease. And what is most important for this population, and not only in Chile, but there are a lot of populations that are where kids are currently exposed to arsenic, to identify biomarkers and maybe even therapeutic targets to either prevent or have early indicators of disease susceptibility in these populations. So with that, I would like to thank my colleague, my former PI, Martin Smith at UC Berkeley, Sylvia Sanchez and Felicia Castroza, who helped me with the TB experiment, my collaborator, Daniel Nomura, who facilitated the lipid metabolomics, and my collaborators Greg Stamos, Katerina and Ferriccio, and Alan Smith for the human population study, And then Lee Riley and Sarah Stanley for their advice on the tuberculosis and my funding. And I would like to thank you for listening, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Soleil. We will now take a few minutes to answer any questions. So again, if you have any questions, feel free to type them into the Q&A pod that you see in the lower right-hand corner. We have one question that's been submitted already. The question is, what concentration of arsenic did you use for the macrophage lipid studies?
For the ones that I showed, we used 1 micromolar of MMA3, which is actually one of the metabolites from arsenic, and it's the most toxic one. But we've also been titrating down, and we find still effects at 0.5 and lower. We're actually going lower now as well. So we tried to mimic the exposure levels that were observed in Chile, which is the 1,000 micrograms per liter. But we're also very concerned or interested actually in seeing if lower exposures as, also have similar effects. So we're definitely working on that too.
Okay, thank you. We have another question, actually more of a comment or an observation. Observation is that Alaska has probably the highest naturally occurring arsenic in the United States, and interestingly, a very high prevalence of TB.
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately, I don't have contacts yet to see if there is a correlation or an interaction between these exposures, but definitely populations such as in Alaska are definitely maybe at higher risk than we already thought they were, just if we looked at arsenic or TB alone. This interaction may actually make effects worse, even if you consider how in Chile the early life exposure, which stopped, had so much impact 50 years later in life, that even if we solve the arsenic exposure problem, we're, as long as people are still exposed to TB, or they're still at risk for higher mortality rates from infectious diseases, and on top of that, the cancers that can develop from the arsenic. So even if you stop the exposure scenario, the risk of these combined exposures is bigger than the net effect. Yeah. So Alaska is definitely one of the places where it's co-occurring. Yeah.
Okay. Next question, a little clarification, I guess. Can you provide more background on why you focused on MMA in the in your exciting MAC studies?
Oh, why? Okay. Yes. We have also started comparing the different arsenic components, so inorganic versus the metabolites MMA, and then once arsenic is metabolized in the liver in humans, it's treated as MMA and DMA5, which the DMA5 is a less toxic version of the metabolite of arsenic. But unfortunately, humans don't really metabolize arsenic in a complete way, so you still have exposure to MMA3 as well. And because of that, we initiated our studies with the highest toxicity metabolite. But we're also now including in our studies inorganic arsenic to see if that has an effect on itself as well.
Okay. So next question is, in regions where arsenic levels are high, is the arsenic in the form of inorganic arsenic or the methylated forms? And then are the inorganic arsenic or dimethyl form active in your bone marrow assays?
Yeah. So the exposure to arsenic is often to inorganic, because inorganic arsenic coming from ground ending up in the water. And then the MMA is mostly coming from our own metabolism. My connection is lost. But I'm not sure if that affects. My phone connection is still on, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll keep talking then. Yes. Sorry, I'm thrown off. So the exposure to drinking water is predominantly inorganic arsenic, but because we process metabolize arsenic and we end up with MMA3 and DMA5 as a holistic exposure scenario, we would like to at some point even have all three, a mixture of them in the ratio that we find it, for example, back in their urine, to see if any of these levels of metabolites versus inorganic form also has a different influence on these macrophages. But we're not clear whether macrophages themselves metabolize arsenic per se. So that's why we test them as separate components for now.
Okay, I have just two questions that we'll ask here, and then we will have to move on. Have you considered differentiating the bone marrow-derived macrophage in the presence of arsenic?
Yes. Actually, the later study where we did tuberculosis infection, we actually added arsenic also during differentiation, so to mimic development of the macrophages, because bone marrow, you have the precursors of the macrophages that you can differentiate, but mature macrophages may respond differently than developing macrophages, and we definitely have set up those experiments now to compare mature macrophages with and then exposed to arsenic versus arsenic during differentiation, which mimics the development. And then our in vivo models will actually be a better model for early life exposure only during development, or because then you can time, for example, the week 7 to 10 week of this gestation in humans compared, translates to day 9 to 19, a little 9 to 11 in the window of mice. So you can play with the time frame that you do exposure in mice and then pinpoint when the macrophages are developing and have arsenic exposure occurring during those times. So those experiments are going on right now as well.
Okay, and then the very last question, perhaps a quick answer. Someone was wondering, how do you filter arsenic from the water supply?
That's a technical question. I'm not an engineer, unfortunately, but there are water filters that remove the arsenic, and I believe in treatment plants they do this. So you have these filters that you can put on the individual well, but also treatment plants that take out arsenic. And I'll have to look that up, but I'm not an expert on how that is done. Sorry.
Okay, well, thank you very much. There are several comments here saying great work and great presentation. Thank you for this very useful information. So thank you very much, Dr. Soleil.
Thank you.
We will next hear from Dr. Stefania Cormier. Dr. Cormier is a pulmonary immunotoxicologist with over 16 years of experience in pulmonary immunology and more than 10 years of experience in environmental research. She is recognized internationally for her work in environmental toxicology. She is a reviewer or a member of numerous study sections at the NIH and the USDA, as well as the Medical Research Council of London and the Health Research Board of Ireland. Dr. Cormier serves as PI and director of Louisiana State University SRP Center. She also serves as leader of the NIEHS Superfund Directors Working Group. Dr. Cormier is the Plow Professor of Excellence in Pediatrics, Division of Infectious Disease, Microbiology, Immunology, and Biochemistry, and Physiology at the University of Tennessee Health Sciences Center in Memphis, and Scientific Director of Pediatric Asthma Research at the University of Texas Health Sciences Center and La Bonheur Children's Hospital. In Innovative Louisiana, she maintains a gratis professorship of pharmacology and experimental therapeutics at LSU Health Sciences Center, an adjunct professorship of biological sciences at LSU, and adjunct professorship of pathobiological sciences at LSU School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Cormier, I will now turn this over to you.
Thank you. That was a mouthful. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to present some of my work today, and I hope that you all enjoy my talk. So today I'm going to be talking about Superfund waste and remediation of Superfund sites. A Superfund site is any site within the United States that has been contaminated by hazardous waste, and those hazardous wastes are either pose a threat to human health and or to the environment. And the EPA has designated these sites as areas of cleanup. As of October 3rd, 2016, there are 1,180 of these sites within the United States and 50 that are being proposed to be added to this list.
Steph, I'm sorry to interrupt, but could you get a little bit closer to your microphone?
I'm talking in the phone. Hold on.
Okay.
Help.
Is yep, that's better. Thank you.
I can turn up the volume. Okay. So there are a variety of environmental cleanup methods that are used to treat or remediate waste at Superfund sites. The methods include both thermal and non-thermal remediation techniques. And in some instances, the methods chosen, such as vapor extraction, actually lead to the development of effluent gases, which are either further remediated by thermal techniques such as incineration or bound to activated carbon, and that carbon is then transported off-site and further remediated by incineration, indicating that even though there are a lot of techniques that are being employed to clean up hazardous waste sites, many of those techniques still use thermal processes. At the elevated temperatures that are being used in these thermal remediation processes, there is the formation of these environmentally persistent free radicals, which is a pollutant particle system that our chemists within the Superfund program have identified. We call these EPFRs for short. EPFRs are actually formed when aromatic compounds chemisorb to the surface of particulate matter through transition metal oxides, and they usually form at elevated temperatures that are often found in the cooling zones of incinerators. And the EPFRs that we talk about are formed between 600 and 150 degrees Celsius. And these EPFRs are actually bound to the particle surfaces. Furthermore, as observed in these fly ash samples, and these fly ash samples were taken either directly from the flume within 24 hours, 1 week, 2 weeks, or 3 weeks later, and analyzed by electroparamagnetic resonance spectroscopy. And what we find is that there's the presence of a radical that exists in these fly ashes, and that the radicals actually degrade slowly over time. Hence, our terminology and name for these radicals, environmentally persistent free radicals, or EPFRs. So if we go back to the slide, I mentioned earlier that you can have both thermal and non-thermal remediation processes that occur, and that both of these processes sometimes go through a thermal process to lead to the formation of an EPFR. If we actually take all of these processes into account, we can estimate that there are about 21% of decisions to remediate Superfund sites within the years of 2005 to 2011 that could potentially lead to the formation of these EPFRs, and therefore they represent a significant proportion of the pollutants being formed at Superfund sites. This is a map of Louisiana, and it shows both current in these magenta colors and former EPFR producing sites. These are Superfund sites that are located within Louisiana. In addition, there are sites that we believe do not form EPFRs. And also what's denoted on this map is actually areas of hazardous waste incineration. And if you remember from the prior slide, that some of these non-thermal processes still go through a thermal process where they're transported off-site and typically transported to these hazardous waste incinerator sites for further remediation. indicating that communities that are often affected by EPRs are actually distant from Superfund sites. And therefore, these exposures may occur without community knowledge and our participation in the cleanup event. So it's very difficult to actually acquire enough samples to actually do inhalation studies in animals. And so as part of our Superfund research program, Dr. Lomnicki actually generates these particles where we can actually control for the size of the particles, the chemical composition of the combustion particles, and we can make them in sufficient quantities to do inhalation studies. Now the chemists and the biologists actually have very different depictions of these molecules, and so I'm going to walk you through this. The advantage of having these pollutant particle systems actually made in the laboratory is that we can control for a number of things. First, we can control how the EPR is made, meaning we can control the actual organic molecules and metal species, which are chemiabsorbed to the particulate. In addition, we can make a variety of control molecules, molecules that have just the organic and the pollutant particle, or the non-pollutant particle, silica, amorphous silica in this case. Or we can have a metal and the particle, or just the particles alone. The EPRs are actually formed only in the presence of the organic, which is chemiabsorbed to a metal oxide on a silica particle. And these are actually physisorbed and then chemiabsorbed at a temperature of 230 degrees Celsius. And therefore, you're going to see throughout the talk DCB-230. DCB-230 represents an environmentally persistent free radical that's formed during a combustion process at 230 degrees Celsius and is composed of dichlorobenzene with the metal oxide, which is copper oxide, and amorphous silica. And the control that we'll be using throughout the talk is actually an organic physisorbed to silica, which is combusted at 50 degrees C. And therefore, it's called or denoted as DCB-50 throughout the talk. We are particularly interested in how infants are vulnerable to airborne exposures. So we are interested in infants because the lungs and the immune system are actually still developing in infants, and they have a higher respiratory rate than adults. So they're particularly susceptible to airborne exposures. To understand how infants actually develop disease following acute exposures to particulate pollution, one of the things we do is actually expose neonatal animals. We use what we call neonatal mice. These are not really neonates. This is 7 days after birth when we start exposures, and we expose them for a period of 7 days, 30 minutes per day, and then look at various endpoints on the last day. We expose them using nose-only or whole-body inhalation systems. What's shown here is a nose-only inhalation system, and you can sort of see the aerosolized product coming out of the system. And then 24 hours after the last exposure, we do a variety of different endpoints. We study lung function using resistance compliance measurement instruments. And so we can measure airways hyperreactivity, which is an indicator of asthma. We can measure compliance, which is an indicator of lung injury. We can look at lung histology, and we can look at airways inflammation. One of the things we realized very early on is that when we expose neonatal mice to EPRs or to DCB-230, we see a breakdown of the airway epithelium. So here we're looking at sections that have been immunostained for ECAT hearing, showing the airways epithelium in air, in DCB-50 exposed, and in DCB-230 or EPR exposed mice. And you can see that the epithelium becomes highly disorganized in the animals that are exposed to DCB-230. In addition, we can measure lung leak that occurs only with the DCB-230 exposed animals compared to vehicle or to DCB-50 controlled exposed animals, indicating that there is lung injury and destruction of the epithelial barrier with exposure in neonatal mice. So I'm not going to go through all the data, but basically what we found out is that if you expose neonatal animals to EPRs, then you observe observed an epithelial disorganization, and that this disorganization started around 3 days post-exposure and then repaired pretty rapidly about 6 days post-exposure. This was marked by lung leak and eventually by airways remodeling, and that this epithelial disorganization and damage was actually due to oxidative stress, even though I didn't show you that data. Now, what this did was actually suggest to us that loss of epithelial integrity could lead to vulnerability to respiratory tract viral infections. And so in the next part of the talk, I'm going to talk to you about why we thought this was happening and the mechanisms we believe are occurring. So in the world, there are approximately 1.96 million people who die each year from acute respiratory tract infections. And this is specifically as a result of indoor air pollution. And here we're just looking at levels of deaths from pneumonia within the world. And what we can account for is that as particulate matter increases and exposure increases, the odds ratio for developing an acute lower respiratory tract infection also linearly increases. And so our hypothesis was that if we exposed animals, neonatal mice, to environmentally persistent free radicals, would we see an increase in severity from respiratory tract viral infection? And to do this, we took our model that I showed you earlier where we exposed infant mice to airborne combustion-derived particulate matter, in this case, environmentally persistent free radicals, or DCB-230, for a period of 7 days. When the airway epithelium starts to break down, we then infect them with influenza, and then on the 8th day and or subsequent days post-infection, we measure a variety of endpoints. And these studies were done by Shador Jalagama in the lab and Greg Lee, who graduated from the lab and is working on an MD currently. One of the things we first observed is that if we actually expose mice to DCB-230 or EPFR-containing particles, that the ability of those animals to survive an influenza infection dramatically decreased as compared to animals that were exposed to air and then infected with influenza. Now, there are two things that we also observed that are interesting in this slide. The first is that if we exposed animals to a particle, pollutant particle that actually just contained the organic and the particle and not the EPFR, then the percent survival following influenza infection was no different than that of air-exposed flu-infected mice. In addition, if we actually took mice where superoxide dismutase was overexpressed and therefore they had a higher antioxidant capability, then also the change in mortality following influenza infection was no different than mice exposed to air and infected with influenza, suggesting that the response to EPFRs was radical driven. If we looked at viral load, so TCID50, which is shown on the y-axis, is actually an indication of the amount of virus in the lung, and we're looking at total lung homogenous here, so it's represented in total amount of virus infectious doses per mil. We can see that if we expose animals to the EPFR-containing particle, DCB-230, and then infect them with flu, then the viral load in the lungs 4 days post-infection is actually higher in this group than in any other group. In addition, viral load in these lungs remains high at 8 days post-infection, meaning two things. First, that the infectious dose, even though it's the same amount, has actually allows for higher viral replication in the lungs of animals that are exposed to DCB-230, and that the virus persists for a longer time in the lung, and that this may be responsible for the enhanced disease that we observed. However, if we look at T-cell responses, there was something about the protective T-cell responses that surprised us. And the responses that we're looking at are interferon gamma producing CD8 cells or TC1 cells, and interferon gamma producing CD4 cells or TH1 cells. And here what we see is if we infect an animal with flu that's been exposed to air, we should have TC1 and we should have TH1 responses to protect the animal against severe influenza infection. However, if animals were exposed to TCB 230, the EPR, then the amount of TC1 and TC1 cells was drastically reduced, and that this relied both on the presence of the EPR, since the non-EPR containing particle failed to do this, and it relied on the induction of oxidative stress, since animals that overexpress superoxide dismutase actually had protective immune responses, including both TC1 and TH1 responses to the influenza infection. To understand why we had reduced T-cell responses, effector T-cell responses to environmentally produced environmentally persistent free radicals, we actually looked at T-regulatory cell responses. T-regulatory cells are actually cells that produce IL-10 and are responsible for suppressing immune responses in the lung. And what we found is that with exposure alone in neonatal mice, the number of T regulatory cells increases dramatically in the animals that are exposed to EPRs, but not in the animals that are exposed to air, indicating that these T regulatory cells could be responsible for the reduced T effector cell phenotype that we observed, and therefore responsible for the increased severity of influenza in these mice. To address this question, we did a number of studies. In the first study, we actually depleted T regulatory cells from the lungs of mice that were exposed to EPR. So in this little diagram on the right, you can see our exposure protocol. PC61 is an antibody that depletes T reg cells, and we treated animals with PC61 twice before we infected them with influenza. And then we looked at a variety of responses downstream of that, including viral load and T cell responses and airway histology. What we observed is that by depleting T regulatory cells from the lungs of mice that were exposed to DCB-230, we can increase the T cell responses to influenza, including increasing TH1, and TC1 responses, and bringing at least the TC1 responses back up to baseline levels, and the TH1 responses were actually brought above baseline homeostatic levels of influenza alone. As a validation experiment, what we did was we also took T cells from the lungs of animals that had been exposed to DCB-230, or the EPR. We isolated the T regulatory cells from those populations and then adoptively transferred them into mice that had been exposed to air and infected them with influenza, to see whether or not these T regulatory cells could actually suppress the immune response to influenza, even in mice that had never been exposed to the environmentally persistent free radicals. And then we looked at immune cell responses and lung function. Here we're looking at the images showing both the flow cytometry plots and the column graph data. These are TC1 cells, so interferon gamma-producing CD8 cells. And then here we're looking at interferon gamma-producing CD4 cells. And we're looking at three different populations. Mice that are exposed, the lungs, the T cells from mice that are exposed to air and infected with influenza, mice that are exposed to DCB-230 or the EPR and infected with influenza, and then mice that are exposed to air but receive T regulatory cells from the DCB-exposed mice and infected with influenza. And then the same populations on this side. And what we can see is that if we adoptively transfer T regulatory cells from mice that are exposed to EPRs, then those T regulatory cells can inhibit T effector cell function even in animals that are exposed to air, indicating that the T regs are responsible for the suppressed effector T cell responses that we're observing. If we look at the lungs from those animals, these two are wild-type animals that were exposed to DCB-230 or the EPR and then infected with influenza. You can see there's a significant amount of inflammation. And then if we look at flu, you can see that the lungs have a lot of influenza in them. If we then take mice in which IL-10 is knocked out, so this is the effector cytokine for T regulatory cells, we can see that we reduce the amount of airways inflammation significantly and reduce the amount of viral load also in the lungs. And we've done other studies where we add back IL-10 and show the opposite effects. So in summary, if we have air-exposed mice, we infect them with influenza. We infect them with influenza, they develop a nice adaptive T-cell response, and then the virus is cleared and no long-term effects occur. However, if we have mice that are exposed to EPRs during that influenza infection, the infection is more severe because T regulatory cells increase and they secrete an increased amount of IL-10, both of which block adaptive T-cell responses, leading to increased pulmonary viral load and increased influenza disease severity. Now, earlier I mentioned that EPRs are concerned because of Superfund remediation, but is EPR exposure just a Superfund-related problem? And we don't think so. So these are studies showing various combustion products and the presence of EPRs in these various combustion products. And this is a study from another lab showing the presence of EPRs in a variety of different combustion processes, including diesel exhaust particles, so from diesel exhaust or gasoline exhaust or gasoline combustion, from wood smoke, from PM2.5, and then from cigarette tar.
Steph, you have about 5 minutes.
And if we measure, if we actually obtain PM2.5 samples from a variety of different cities across the United States, we can measure and detect the quantity of EPRs present in those samples. And the EPR concentration within those samples also decays at a similarly slow rate to that seen in Superfund sites. So these are PM samples that were collected in Baton Rouge, and we can measure the presence of those EPRs over a period of some 54 days, and the half-life of these EPRs being somewhere around 21 days. Globally, PM2.5 is a bigger problem than Superfund sites. This is a map of average annual PM2.5 levels, and you can see that they're elevated in countries other than the United States, and it's estimated that there are some 2 billion children that live in areas where PM2.5 levels exceed international limits. So this is a global problem. So one of the things we're doing is currently looking at the population of Memphis, and we're looking at pneumonia cases in Memphis and relating it to PM2.5 levels within the area of Memphis as an indicator of EPR exposure. And we're looking at downstream events such as length of stay and admission to ICU for pneumonia. And while these studies are in their infancy, what we can say is that proximity to PM2.5 sources actually can predict pneumonia severity in children. And that prediction allows for a prediction of how long those infants will be hospitalized with pneumonia and the odds ratio for them developing pneumonia based on the distance from the PM source. So in conclusion, EPR exposure in infant mice induces oxidative stress. This disrupts the airway epithelium, and that leads to suppression of effector T-cell responses, allowing for increased incidence and severity of respiratory tract viral infections. More importantly, the existence of EPRs in airborne PM2.5 represents a new paradigm for evaluating the toxicity of airborne 2.5, and we hope to continue with translating this data to the human population. I obviously don't do this alone. I have a number of people in the lab that help, and the majority of the work I showed you today was done by Sridhar Jaligama, a PhD, who just finishing his postdoc with me and just took a job at Patel, Jagla Menso-Wesley, a critical care fellow who's been working in the lab, and Greg Lee, who's a MD, PhD, currently working on a residency in dermatology, I believe. And none of this work could be done without Flavo and Barry Dellinger over at LSU and Baton Rouge. Tony Oyana is helping with the GIS information and the PM2.5 human translational data, and Dr. Dugas for the oxidative stress. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Cormier. I guess we will open this up to questions. So if you have any questions, go ahead and type them into the Q&A pod that you see, again, in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. Give people a minute to type things in. We can also open this up to the phone lines. Again, if you have questions on the phone, you just need to unmute by pressing #6. We then ask that you state your name and organization and your question, and then when you're done, you can remute your phone by using *6. Okay, so here's a question. Are the conditions for the EPFR formation very specific? Person's wondering about the processes like concrete manufacturing. I guess specific for their source, perhaps.
So we haven't actually tried to detect it in every process, but the majority of processes where there is a combustion process that's occurring and there are metals present, and an organic present, then we have detected EPFRs being formed. I am not really sure how concrete's manufactured. I know it's a thermal process, but I'm not sure what temperatures it gets to. And we could definitely look at it, but we have not looked at that specifically.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Any idea how oxidants present in the atmosphere, like ozone, could alter the oxidative potential of PM2.5.
So we are looking at that as part of our studies, and we have a number of a group of chemists actually who are looking at those processes, and it seems to actually increase the radical content of those, but then light also affects it. So separating out those effects are something that we're very interested in doing, and we hope to have information on that in the future.
What are your thoughts on how light affects things?
Yeah. So we have done some of those studies, because EPFRs are actually not only just found in the air, they're actually found in the soil around Superfund sites. And so we have collected samples from various levels of dirt to look at how light is affecting it. And we believe light is increasing the EPFR potential. But it depends on the metal, and it depends on the organic that's involved. The underlying theme is that there is an EPFR there. And then depending on the type of metal and the organic, the stability of that EPFR changes. But they're all very persistent. It's not like when you think of a radical, it's milliseconds of a half-life. It's they're all days to weeks to months of persistence.
Next question. Could you comment on whether similar effects of exposure on influenza outcome are observed if exposures ended before influenza infection, given that the, quote, lung leak is restored? So is it reversible, or would there be long-term effects?
So if the exposure occurred, we've done some of these studies. If we expose the animals to the pollutant particle, we stop the exposure and the lung repairs and then infect them with influenza, there's no long-term effect that we can differentiate. However, if we do in utero exposures where we expose mom to the EPFR or to the pollutant, and then when the pups are born, we infect them with influenza, those pups are predisposed to develop the TH2 type response, and therefore they're less protected against respiratory tract viral infections.
Okay, we have a question here. What is the best way to archive PM2.5 samples that would allow you to measure EPFR levels? And then if so, for how long?
That's a million-dollar question. So we do freeze the samples, so we have to make sure the samples are dry and then frozen, and then they maintain some radicals over a very long period of time. And they have to be under vacuum. But the best way to store them would be under vacuum. So either put them under argon or nitrogen gas and make sure they're sealed. That as far as we know, they'll persist that way for an indefinite period of time as long as there's no leaks in the seal.
Okay. I'll wait just one more minute here to see if any more questions pop up.
One of the most interesting things we saw, which I didn't touch on in this talk, is actually we were trying to find the right control to show that EPRs were responsible for these effects. And so one of the things I did as the biologist was to sit the sample out on the bench and let it decay. And so we waited for the half-life to be exceeded by several weeks, and then we put those samples, the decayed samples, back into a biological system. And one of the things we found, which surprised us, and we needed Dr. Dellinger and Slava Lomnicki from LSU to actually help us figure this out, and Dr. Duga, was that these radicals, even though they decayed, they were capable of cycling through Fenton reactions, and so they were capable of regenerating hydroxyl radicals once you put them in a biological system.
Okay, I think we've got one last question here, and this will end our session. Oops, I just made it disappear. There we go. Do EPRs form detectable addicts with macromolecules?
We're not sure. Dr. Lomnicki is actually working on that now.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Cormier, and thank you to all of our speakers. Before we want to make sure everyone is aware of the Related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and the seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it at any point after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Also, in the related URLs pod, you'll find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as they continue, as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event, should you need one. I would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any future webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page. You can follow the EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter. You can join the Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN LinkedIn group. You can visit the Superfund Research Program Risky Learning webpage, and you can follow the Superfund space NIEHS on Twitter. So I think at this point we are about out of time. So if you do have any questions, additional questions, you can contact us via email, and our email address then is shown on the seminar homepage and on the CLUIN page. I would also like to thank our presenters, Dr. Kleeberger, Soleil, and Cormier, for their time preparing for and sharing their presentations with us today. This should conclude then today's presentation. Thank you all for your participation.